So I'm Ashley Frawley. I'm senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at Swansea University. I'm the author of a book called Semiotics of Happiness, which is a terrible, terrible title, which basically looks at the rise of happiness as a social problem in the UK. And it's now, you know, morphed into well-being and mental health, which is the topic of my second book, Significant Emotions, which is due out next year.
Hi, I'm Nico Sotirakopoulos. I'm a lecturer in sociology and criminology at York St. John University. I've also wrote a book called The Rise of Lifestyle Activism from New Left to Occupy. And at the moment, I'm writing a book on left-wing and right-wing tribalism. And the two books I've read most times in my life were Das Kapital by Marx and Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. So, yeah, that's me.
Well, I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of the Zero Books and the host of the podcast. Welcome to the Zero Squared podcast. I have to admit that I'm feeling a little bit like Jordan Peterson, meaning that I have not ever read any Ayn Rand. So you'll have to inform me as we discuss about Ayn Rand's arguments. I have the typical far leftist disdain for her, but I have to admit I'm not that educated on her work.
Zizek has an excellent understanding of Atlas Shrugged. He's so I encourage you to, I think you're gonna enjoy it. So yeah, I definitely encourage you to read it, or at least, but no, don't watch Zizek before you read it, because he includes spoilers.
Okay, I won't watch Zizek before I read it, but I do admire the fact that she's a novelist as well as a philosopher. You know, I write science fiction myself, and so I like that. And I'm you know, not an expert, but I know a bit about Nietzsche, and I understand Nietzsche was a big influence on Ayn Rand. So maybe we can find some more.
Kind of, but let's have a whole episode on Ayn Rand, because we need to talk 5 hours about it.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll do that. I'll read Atlas Shrugged before the end of the year, and I'll invite you back.
Oh, that would be so fun.
Okay, but let's talk about the Zizek-Jordan Peterson debate. I have just rewatched a segment of it. I started after they'd each given their presentation and watched about 45 minutes of it again, because when I watched it originally, I was on a Discord live stream, or like a Discord stream, doing running commentary and watching the questions come in from people who are fans of Zero Books or like the podcast. And I didn't catch everything that was said, so I thought I needed to watch and listen again. And it's more interesting even than I originally thought. I have my own questions, but they're very much focused around a leftist perspective. Nikos, is that how I would say your name? Nikos?
Yes.
Why don't you start with your impressions and some questions or comments you might have about the debate?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing about this debate is not so much the debate itself, but how many people were interested in it and how many people have watched it. So we haven't got the official statistics of how many people officially subscribe to it, but from the various streams, we have more than 1.5 million viewers in less than a week. This shows that people are starving for ideas, which I think is excellent. Now, the debate itself didn't have many surprises for people who have read Zizek and Peterson. And I think, as we expected, they have more in common rather than the things they disagree with. It definitely was not a Marxism versus capitalism debate, because Peterson did a very poor job defending capitalism, Peterson did a poor job defending capitalism, and Zizek, as he usually does, did not really went a full-on defense of Marxism or communism or whatever. It was good fun seeing them together, but it was not the debate of the century. This debate remains to happen.
Well, I would agree it was not the debate of the century. I would say that I thought that Zizek defended Marx and Marx's writings well enough for my satisfaction, and I consider myself to be a kind of a wannabe Marxist or a kind of Marxist, although not aligned with any particular sect at the moment. I would say that from my perspective, it was just hands down a win for the left. That what happened was Žižek managed to deflate a central element of Peterson's project, which was the neo-Marxist, the postmodern neo-Marxist figure.
Yeah.
That figure was dead by the end of the debate there.
Žižek knows Marx better than Peterson does. And at the same time, Žižek understands what passes for the right or for conservatism or for capitalism also better than Peterson does. So in a way, it was very easy for Žižek to win this debate because he didn't really have an opponent. He had a discussant who was not necessarily an ideological opponent. So, yeah, I would agree with you that probably maybe Žižek came out as something like the winner. But that was not that difficult because where the debate went, it was good for him. So he called Peterson on his very poor understanding of Marxism, of Marx himself. He didn't have someone who really pushed him on what are potential problems with Marxism. And he didn't have someone who would go with the moral support of capitalism. Therefore, at the end of the day, Žižek didn't have a difficult mission.
Right. And I think that's significant. And I actually don't think that we should fault Jordan Peterson for that. Like, I feel as though one of the things that came out at the end was that I despite the fact that I think Peterson is some sort of reactionary or has a reactionary tendency, I also think that a countervailing force in his personality is his intellectual openness, even if he's not as well versed in philosophy and politics as I would hope he would be, given he's a major figure right now. But I saw him as being fundamentally intellectually honest, if not correct, in the debate. And so that was...
Yeah, and the other thing that... The one thing actually that Peterson, in a way, won, and he was much better than Žižek, he was doing a big... He was putting a big effort to be articulate. And this was specific on the part with happiness. He tried to come up with something like a good definition of happiness. We can discuss later what the problem with that definition is. But at least he put the effort. And also, the amicable atmosphere also was something which is a takeaway from this discussion, that presumably two people, you know, the best intellectual that the left has to offer and the best intellectual that conservatism or Judeo-Christian tradition or however you want to call it has to offer, they had a good discussion. So this was a nice spectacle. But the problem is, again, it didn't go down to the basics. It didn't go down to the fundamentals.
Okay. Ashley, what did you think?
I think Žižek won the debate because, well, for the reasons that you said, but also because he pulled this wonderful, good old Uncle Slavoj kind of. You know, he was really charming and kind. And, you know, people wanted him to, like, take down Peterson point by point. And, you know, he got some flack for that in the commentary afterward. You know, why didn't you, like, take Peterson to task for that really, really embarrassing opening speech about the Communist Manifesto? But that, I thought it was so skilled that he didn't do that, because it just would have been so silly. And also, you would never expect Žižek to do that. Like, you would... You know, that was never going to happen. Instead, he was just really kind, and he took him to task for the postmodern neo-Marxist thing, and in a really clever, kind way, showed what a bunch of nonsense it was. And I think it's really indicative, actually, of the sort of the way that we should be discussing things now. Is I feel like we're always trying to show how smart we are and how to talk down to people and humiliate them and destroy them, when really you should try to win people over and try to get them on your side. And I think that's what we need to do. I didn't, you know, and the debate went down exactly as anybody who knows Zizek and knows Peterson, that's all that could have happened. Could you imagine Zizek doing like debate style, point by point? No, I'm just glad that he stopped talking at some point. That was the big surprise for me.
Yeah, he would manage to be relatively constrained. So I'm of two minds here. On the one hand, I agree that it would have been a mistake for him to try to correct Peterson's interpretation of the Communist Manifesto, although I think it would be a mistake in it for a number of reasons. One of which you just mentioned, which was that it wouldn't have been a way to open up the conversation and kind of charm people onto your side to do that. The other thing that
also it would give it too much credence. Like you don't like argue with a teenager who's handing in the book report, you know, like,
right. That's right. But on the other hand though, I think it's interesting from my perspective on this is that there really isn't a lot of agreement on the left about these documents either. Like if he had gone through a refutation, he would have also presented his own interpretation, which he has one. And I don't think that would have protected him from criticism from people at Jackman or Counter or Current Affairs or other places, because there's so much disagreement on the left and so little consensus about just either like even what class is, for instance, that what you have to do is welcome people into a discussion about these issues rather than try to set down the definition from the start. And I think that's what was really good about this debate was that it was a sincere conversation about real problems in the world, and it was starting from the perspective of trying to get at solutions and an understanding rather than trying to enforce or push forward a preset explanation and solution. So that's...
Can I put an objection here, though?
Yes, please do.
So supposedly both Zizek and Peterson are the biggest kind of enemies of postmodernism and the biggest, the fierce criticism of postmodernism. Did you notice, though, that both failed to define their terms? So this was supposedly a debate about happiness, communism, and capitalism. Only at some point there was an attempt to define happiness, an attempt by Peterson, which was kind of okay, but with a major flaw. But beyond that, there was no definition of these terms. And I can totally understand what you say, that specifically Zizek, with all this sectarianism on the left, and since he doesn't want to put himself outside of the leftist milieu, you know, he didn't want to create more, let's say, controversies, but I think it would definitely be worth it to at least try to define the terms of the discussion.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say that he was trying to avoid controversy. That's not really my point. I mean, I think I may have implied that, and I don't really mean to. What I'm saying is that if we imagine a world in which Zizek did go through point by point on the Communist Manifesto, that wouldn't have stopped the controversy. The critiques that he would be getting would be similar. Because there would be...
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely, yes.
But I guess what I want to say also is that, you know, as someone who's trying to understand Hegel and Marx, starting out with a clear definition of your term may not be the best approach if you're trying to think dialectically. So, like, I would want to, rather than define postmodernism, I would want to describe it. And I think you'd have to describe it as it developed historically. Like, how did it arise? Mm-hmm. What did it arise in reaction to? Because postmodernism itself, there are debates within that realm of thought about what postmodernism is or whether or not that term is even meaningful within that milieu. So you're not going to find a simple, clear definition of postmodernism. I mean, one of the things that occurred recently on my Facebook wall was I put out a video about postmodernism, critiquing postmodernism, and a friend of mine who teaches critical theory in California chimed in and said that there is no such thing as postmodernism. And I said, yes, this is the ultimate postmodern position. and no, he said, but no, really, there isn't. There is something called post-structuralism, and you can, but there's not, postmodernism is a bastardization of theory. And that's true enough, but it also is true that that kind of mistaken interpretation of post-structuralism and deconstruction has taken on a life of its own and is kind of a theory now. Itself. So,
but isn't the job of the philosopher to at least try to find a definition which includes, let's say, the fundamental and or the essential element of what this concept that he's describing is? So, I don't think that we should shy away, and specifically, you know, the giants of public intellect like Zizek and Peterson shouldn't shy away from at least attempting to describe or not only describe, but also define this phenomena. Because if you define it, then you put also the other people you discussed, you put them on the spot. So you say, okay, this is, you claim this is not postmodernism, but don't you see this one, two, three things? And then you can have a better basis for discussion, because otherwise, instead of discussion, what you have is more parallel monologues, each one in his own, let's say, universe of meaning, and we are walking in parallel, but we never kind of meet each other, and we never talk, or we never talk the same language.
Well, I feel like we've right away have jumped into kind of a deep question, because I don't think you're entirely wrong about the need to differentiate and describe your concepts, and whether or not that comes down to a neat and tidy definition, I'm a little wary of that idea, but on the other hand, it is really useful to have a definition in your mind. But whenever you try to define something, you're often going to find exceptions. Like I recall trying to state something that I thought was obviously true in a conversation, which was that there is a biological difference between men and women around reproduction. And that, you know, a woman has the capacity to bear young, and that is a mark of difference. And, you know, immediately and somewhat rightly, my interlocutor said, oh yeah, but so you're saying an infertile woman isn't a woman? And so obviously my definition wasn't adequate, that I didn't only mean that I wanted to hold on to that definition, but it needed to be expanded or complicated. And so I said something like, well, a person who, you know, has a genetic prop, you know, is set up to have those capacities. And, you know, even if it's a woman whose reproductive abilities has failed, she's still in that category, just like a worker who's unemployed is still a worker. But, you know, it was not entirely satisfactory to try to.
Yeah, but the other person understood what you were talking about. So probably it was more about trying to, you know, play devil's advocate, because a good definition means we at least talk about the same thing. My issue.
Yeah,
is, but I think,
yeah, no. See, the thing is that when you try to do this, you're pulling a bit of a sleight of hand, because you want us to start with definitions and agree on them. But actually, your whole universe of meaning is packed into that definition. So you can't start with the definitions. See, so then you'll try to, by trying to bring in a definition, you're trying to bring the debate on your terms.
It is a framing. It is a way to frame. The question isn't, for me, the question isn't whether or not that's a cheat, but whether or not it's avoidable. I mean, you know, I do think it's necessary to start with a concept, but you have to interrogate it. So, you know, you might have a definition, but then you have to discover to the degree to which it's adequate. But it's okay to start with a definition. And so,
yeah, but there's a difference between like having a dialectical understanding of something. So something comes about as a result of certain conditions, and that's descriptive. But when you try to have a definition that captures the essence of something, that often becomes prescriptive. So it becomes that's what it should be. And when something doesn't live up to that definition, you go, well, see, now we must change the world so that it fits my definition.
Or we must change the definition. But here's an example from the debate. So by failing to define capitalism, Peterson finds himself not having a reply to Zizek's claim, for example, that, you know, capitalism is to blame, I don't know, for the destruction in Yemen, right? So here's that's the main problem. So Peterson didn't have the intellectual ammunition to fight back on these claims. So he didn't, for example, so Zizek did a very good critique to the world out there, but in my opinion, he didn't do a very good critique of capitalism, because most of the things that he described have very little to do with, like, laissez-faire capitalism. And Peterson, because he had a very vague understanding of capitalism, something like, oh, it's good because it produces the results and kind of allows hierarchies to operate, which I have to say is the worst defense of capitalism I've heard in my life. Literally, Marx provides a better defense of capitalism in the manifesto than some of the points that Peterson made. So that's why I didn't see a good dialogue, and that's why if I were Peterson, I would begin by definition, because the way I see it, definition describes reality, does not prescribe it.
Okay, so I think that this gets to a question that I had written down at the start, which is this: should Zizek have defended Marx or Marxism more definitively? And so you notice the word definitively is in there. I do think that if you listen to this debate again, there are moments where obviously contested terrains and deeper understanding opens up. In other words, there's obvious moments where they only slide across the surface of an idea. I think the idea that they actually wrestled with the most thoroughly, and maybe this is only because I don't study this, is happiness. And the communism mm-hmm. and capitalism were both given short shrift in the debate. Nonetheless, though, I think it was worthwhile and was maybe the debate of the moment, because it did open up interest in these ideas, and it didn't try to say that what had been said was the end. It did set up maybe future dialogues and future explorations. But I did, if I had been on that stage, I would have certainly pushed on. I would have defended Marx more thoroughly than Zizek did. And one of the ways I would have done that would have been to bring up what I think of as the central insight of Marx, which is that the consequences of our social relationships and around production are fundamental, and that we have the capacity to change the social relationship that sets up our productive activity, and that it's not a matter of overcoming an oppressor, but changing the terms of a relationship. And how we want to do that, you know, has to be debated and thoroughly thought through. But that, you know, you have to understand terms like value and labor time and all of these things to at least understand Marx, and I would say understand how capitalism functions.
Isn't this what they try to do towards the end with the whole discussion on whether you start by cleaning your room, which is like Peterson's catchphrase, or whether you start by cleaning, let's say, your neighborhood, which is, would say, society. And even then, I don't think there was a major disagreement. So they seem to agree that there is this relationship between obviously starting by sorting yourself out, but then if you live, for example, in, I don't know, North Korea or under Sharia law, there are limitations on what you can achieve.
Yeah, it was not defined how you start to try to change your social situation. It was only that we might want to change our social situation rather than only changing our individual behavior. But it wasn't getting to questions of what aspect of our social life needs to be altered first, or what's the most fundamental aspect of our social life, what sets up all of our other relations. And I think that's what Marx argues for, is that our material and productive activity, the activity that both transforms the world and provides the means of our sustenance, that is the fundamental activity. and it sets up many other relations, which aren't always even fixed. There can be a variety of relations that come out of the same fundamental social relation, which is a class-based social relation where value is produced through labor time. Anyway, so I'll stop there. Ashley?
But do you think Zizek is ready to have this discussion? Because I don't think he is, because then he'd have to somehow reveal what's like, at least towards the end game, and he's not ready to do that.
Well, I've talked about this with Zizek, but Ashley, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just about to say that if you, you know, when Zizek has been pushed, or if you read his books, when he starts to move on to the terrain of value, it's clear that he doesn't, that he's broken with the labor theory of value. And for that reason, he's not the best. Well, I mean, we wanted to see Zizek versus Peterson, and that's what we got. But you want to see Peterson debate a Marxist, you know, get a Marxist. You know, he's a Hegelian, and he admits that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I have to confess that when I think of the really solid Marxists in the way that I think of it, I don't think of characters who would do well on that stage for the most part.
I know. Yeah.
You people would do well on that stage. I'm not even kidding. You should at some point. That's why I'm saying this debate still needs to be happen, but it needs different people in both sides.
This is what I think is really what really bothered me about a lot of people's reaction to the debate, both before and after. Some people that, you know, Doug and I both know, who really just thought this debate should never happen because Zizek's giving credence to this guy and, you know, giving credibility to him just by him being on the same stage. And I hate that argument. I'm sick and tired of the moral high ground. Like, that's all politics is, you know. It's just politics in one person, in my moral purity, like the politics of throwing your friends under the bus for the sake of moral and political purity, because your lifestyle and your individuality is the be all and the end all of everything that you see. And in that sense, there's no point in having any debate. You know, how, you know, it would tarnish my soul. It would be a black mark on my perfect, you know, this perfect persona that I'm cultivating, which is so, so self-defeating, and it's so alienating. I want us to be debating stuff all the time. I don't get the impulse to shut down debate. Like, I want to confront people I disagree with because I want to be right. Like, how can I know that I'm right if I never confront disagreement? Every time that I disagree with somebody, my arguments move forward in some way, or I change my mind.
And especially if you are debating someone who's smarter than you are, which happens to me all the time. So,
I came of age debating Nikos, who's much smarter than me.
Yeah,
the same with me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, and this is a compliment, you people were my last kind of step, my last stop in Marxism. I was like, okay, since I can't find my answers to clever people like you guys, I'm off.
So wait, well, you're saying we pushed you out of Marxism, or explain that again?
Yeah, but that's a compliment. That's a compliment. Like no, you were my last hope because you are good.
Well, okay.
No, you weren't far enough. Jesus.
Oh man, I feel bad. Well, okay, let's. I want to say one thing, and then I want to ask Nico something. So what I want to say is, I was interviewed about this debate before it happened, and I read the interview, and unfortunately, it's one of those moments where the one thing you say that you sort of wish you could retract or reframe, you know, was quoted. But what I said was that Zizek wins this debate simply by being on stage with Peterson. Because now Peterson has legitimated Marxism. And I didn't quite mean it that way, but I was sort of just turning everything around. Certainly Peterson has the larger audience than Zizek, although it may be not as vast a difference as I originally thought. But also, though, Peterson's whole approach to the left has been to demonize them and to be forced to share a stage with Zizek and not be in a position, especially as it turned out, not to be in a position of demonizing Zizek as it goes along. did do a lot, I think, to allow for Marxist ideas to be made no longer taboo. But Nikos, I want to ask you, like, what was your primary question or problem with the Marxist tradition, and what is it about Ayn Rand that brought you over to becoming, a libertarian?
Yeah, I wouldn't use the term libertarian because that's too vague. But yeah, I'm someone interested in Rand. So my answer is the answer that Peterson should give to Zizek. And it's going to sound provocative, but I'm not saying it to provoke. When he was asked, name me someone who's a Marxist and a postmodernist, maybe an answer could be Marx himself when it comes to his epistemology, which means when it comes to how he understands the theory of knowledge. So how would you people define postmodernism? Because describe. A usual description is the negation of, let's say, universal paradigms. But then if we take this a step further and we ask ourselves, where does this negation come from? We will see that it comes from the belief that the way you come into contact with reality through your reason is not valid by itself, and there's no guarantee of validity there. And my problem is that I see something like that also in Marx. Actually, Marx doesn't even give us a clear view of his epistemology, and it comes to his critique of ideology, which is very interesting because he doesn't say, for example, that false consciousness is false, but therefore there is a right consciousness. And correct me if I'm wrong here. But that's how I understand Marx, and that's how some Marxists that I kind of trust understand Marx. Therefore, because I think we are people who have faith in human potential and in individuality and in agency, if you need to kind of have this understanding where reality is up for grabs, that nature, reality is there to be tamed, to be conquered, then the first thing you have to defend is individual agency and reason. Now, my problem with Marx is that he didn't do a very good job with this. And my big, big, big problem with postmodernism is that they took this to its extreme. But I think this has a root in Marx. And that's why I think that Marxism, at the end of the day, although he has all this optimism about agency and change in history, this agent is not the rational individual. This agency is something which is a bit mystical. He has this quasi-tribalist understanding of who is going to be this agent, who's going to change the world. And this is why I, let's say, parted ways with Marxism. And also, I think this is where Peterson should attack ferociously Zizek. He told him, you have invited the dragon in the home, but he didn't explain why and what this dragon is, which for me, everything starts from epistemology.
Okay. All right. That's really interesting. I have a response to it, but I want to let Ashley go first just to see if she'll add to my understanding before I go. Ashley?
Can I add to yours? Because I've jotted down some notes.
Yeah, that's fine. So,
but about false consciousness. Are you going to go to false consciousness?
I'm not going to go to false consciousness, so that's fine. I'm not going to go to that kind of question about ideology and what's the difference between alienation and exploitation. I haven't read everything by Marx. I've read more than Jordan Peterson. But I haven't read everything. But my thought about this is that if you want to understand Marx's epistemology, you really need to start with Hegel, because I don't think Marx explicitly argues out an epistemological position in his work. None that I've encountered. So it's there, but it's there in the background. It's there in his methodology more than it's there explicitly argued. So if we it may be a little different than Hegel's understanding of epistemology, but it's fundamentally similar. And so one thing that I was forced to do as I kind of explored these ideas was debate Well, I was constantly called an idealist by a friend of mine and interlocutor, Derek Varn. And I went around and around on this. And he and I together read Marx's critique of Hegel's philosophy in general, rather than his critique of... there's another critique of Hegel that's more often read. So... Yeah, philosophy of right, and not that one. It was his critique of philosophy in general, which was never published in his lifetime. He didn't seek to publish it, but I read it. And what I came to was that there is a kind of reluctant idealist aspect to Marx. And what I mean by that is that Marx does have a concept of reason, and it's a Hegelian concept of reason. And Zizek said something during the debate, which I think is clarifying, which was that to act is always to err, is always to make a mistake. And that also means that our conceptions of the world are never full or complete or correct, fundamentally. And I think that's just an obvious fact. Because we are finite beings with a certain kind of sensory apparatus and a certain shape of our brain. So we're going to only be able to interpret a spectrum of what exists. And that means leaving out quite a lot. And so what that doesn't mean, though, is that this is where it gets complicated. What that doesn't mean is that we are simply completely cut off from the world, living in kind of a solipsistic bubble. And it also doesn't mean that there isn't such a thing as reason, which we can employ in order to adequately understand our reality, our place in the world. What it does mean is that understanding is a process rather than something that arrives in full. And it may be a process that doesn't have a termination point. It's hard to conceive of what we would have to do to develop ourselves to be able to take in the true totality of everything that existed. And whether or not, and for me, I wonder if in order to do that, would we have to become identical with everything that existed? You know, at that point, you're talking about trying to understand the mind of God, basically.
Yeah, that's what we call omniscience.
This is a good place to sort of jump in that that the way human beings, his understanding of human reason is not that, you know, that we have this kind of false consciousness that casts doubt on human reason in the abstract. It's that we alienate ourselves from ourselves, our creativity from ourselves. So he jumps off of Feuerbach, you know. So Feuerbach says that we all this time we've been projecting onto God what was actually human beings and so on. But God made man, right? So, but Marx takes this like dialectically. So God made man, but in his own image. But of course, no, that's not the case. Man made God in his own image. But the next step is that man is God. So, but it's not just the fact that the fact that we are not gods right now isn't just us not realizing it. We're not there. We're not fully free or capable of creating life on other planets or whatever, because the economic base of society is not sufficiently developed to allow human reason to be fully free. So our separation from ourselves isn't just ideal, but it's real, because we really can't self-determine on the basis of reason right now. So it's this understanding of our understanding of the world gradually unfolds, and our realization of that it's been us all along, that we've been always been God, unfolds as the reality of that unfolds, and we become more and more able to realize our true nature of whatever.
Okay, can I throw in an idea on top of that? I would say that all of that, what you just said, is basically true, and I agree with it, except that I would want to throw in this rejoinder, which is that the understanding of our own godhood is a deflationary experience and has to be. That it's not that when we imagined God outside of our own understanding, then we could be supported by something whole and full. And when we understand our own responsibility for shaping our future and taking on the task of, you know, going to other worlds and expanding our range of power and authority, let's say, as a species, we also have to understand that that's happening within a context in which whatever move we make, and this is the Zizekian kind of point, we will be off, that there is no correct approach. There is no whole, total understanding. It's only a process of development. And we have always had the possibility of going well off the rails, but we're also like put in the position of being responsible for determining when we've done that. But what we can know, this is what makes me different than a postmodernist, is what we can know is the fact of our responsibility, that there is a universal, and it's this split between subject and object. This
can I make two comments on that?
Yeah,
very quick.
Mm-hmm.
The first is it's good that you brought Feuerbach, because in a way Marx's problem with Feuerbach is also that Feuerbach begins with the individual, and the fact that Marx considered this a problem makes me consider Marx's approach a problem. But more importantly on what you said, I wouldn't consider this a bug, the fact that we cannot conceive, let's say, the whole. Because instead of going to Hegel, why not go to Aristotle? Everything has an identity, everything has a nature. The same is with our consciousness. So the fact that human consciousness cannot have this omniscience, I'm never sure if I pronounce this word, but so the fact that we cannot know everything, let's say, at once, that's a feature, that's not a bug. So there's nothing, let's say, to feel bad about the capacity for reason and knowledge by the fact that we cannot have this again, omniscience, let's put it this way.
Yeah, but the difference between Aristotle and Hegel, and why Hegel, there was a powerful side of Hegel, was so Hegel made the contrast between the endless reproduction of nature. So for Aristotle, everything has an eudaimonia. Eudaimonia is the goal of life, which is to live up to your true spirit, right? Which is always exists within the individual, like a seed contains the essence of the plant that it's going to become, right? So, but for Hegel, everything is always becoming. And so there's a contrast between the endless reproduction of nature, which produces more or less the same thing over and over and over again, and human beings for whom what we become is endless. So it's what we become versus becoming.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with that. That's basically what.
So then you couldn't define what it means to be happy, for instance, or human, because it's boundless and open.
Yeah, as Ayn Rand would put it, we don't go in circles like animals. We have a straight line towards the target that we set and towards the purpose. And again, that's what makes us special, and this is something to be celebrated.
Right, but a Marxist observation would be that we have this target, or maybe it's a Zizekian observation, really. We have this target. Well, it depends on the register. So we have this target that we're setting out to reach, but from a Zizekian perspective, what will happen is that as you move to reach it, the target itself will change in character, because your movement is impacting how you understand and conceive of your target. And at a certain point, it may be that the target no longer functions and that you need to change
your target. Example?
Well, the example I would say is the creation of value under capitalism. We have a target of increasing our labor time and increasing our productivity, as understood as abstract labor time. And now, as we've moved forward, we've altered the circumstances of the world to such a degree that that target is no longer adequate for humanity. It needs to be changed so that we can accomplish new, greater things, but also so that we don't self-destruct.
Isn't that good, though?
What, that we need to change the target?
Yeah, at the end of the day, that's a result of Marx.
I mean, Marx,
of human action, yeah.
Well, Marx was not a critic of capitalism because it was an evil, but because he saw its limitations and saw its contradictions and wanted to move beyond it.
And he saw that capitalism was moving beyond itself.
Right. Although, you know, the human activity has to do it. It's not the system itself.
Yes. And of course, the system itself is human relations. It's human beings acting and living together. But through those relations, it creates something that's much bigger than the basis of its own production. So the creation of wealth starts to undermine the production of wealth.
The creation of wealth starts to undermine the creation of value.
Yes, sorry, value. Right. Well,
because
the
value
way that
and
I teach it in my first year module is that value is the source of all of wealth, and wealth is value.
I'm tempted to start a discussion on value here, but I guess probably that's not the time or the place.
I'm tempted too, obviously, but I would just say that value is understood as an abstract, as a measure of abstract labor time, is different.
Yeah, which is the source of all wealth.
Well, under capitalism, it is the source of all wealth, but it also is distinct.
Under capitalism, right. Yes.
But it also is distinct from wealth, because you can have a tremendous amount of wealth, but go into economic crisis because of problems with value production. And not be able to increase value at a sufficient rate to keep operating well. And so you have crisis, even when you're surrounded by useful wealth.
Yeah. Okay. You're talking about wealth as use values.
Right. That's how I would define wealth as use values as opposed to value as abstract.
I would see it as. So what you were just saying, we're going to get into, maybe it's besides the point.
Yeah, no, we should have this discussion, though, sometime, because it's, I think, yeah. But go ahead, say it, too, and I won't respond.
Oh, no, just that when you said that there's this accumulation of wealth, I would say it's the accumulation of, like, lifetimes of of labor that goes, that, you know, and this accumulation of value undermines the production of more value, which is its purpose, right? Its purpose is to create more surplus value. And yet by doing that, it undermines the production of surplus value.
Or maybe it doesn't. And there are other factors that undermine it. But again, to have this discussion, it would be impossible to have this without, again, defining what we mean by capitalism.
But you want to have when you have a relational understanding of capitalism, which Marx has, it means that, and you don't say like, "Oh, capitalism is a system in which these five things are correct." Mm-hmm. It's every time that you look for a definition in Marx, it's always relation. So, what is value? Value is socially necessary labor time. What is socially necessary labor time? It is again a series of relations, and as those relations change, or those relations can change, and we can work to change those relations and then come up with something. Well, by understanding what those relations are, we can hopefully come to rationally understand the conditions of our existence and to change them.
Aristotle versus dialectics. I go with the former, sorry.
Okay, but that's
there not... Are no
but why do you do that? You can't just assert that.
Well, because it's, again... If we negate that there are no contradictions in the universe, we then very quickly, before we realize it, we're going to find ourselves within the postmodernist universe. So we cannot be the serfs of two masters. It's impossible to believe that there are contradictions in terms of A is not A, to put in Aristotelian terms. And then also, for example, that's how I mean we end up with weird phrases like, sorry, I'm bringing it down from the sphere of philosophy, but I think it's important. That's why you hear, for example, the postmodernists or whoever these people are saying things like, you can be a you cannot be a racist if you're a white person. And if you push them, they will give you an answer that if you take step back, it's going to end up 10 or 15 steps later to the fact that, well, yeah, that's basically a dialectical contradiction. That's a relationship. And because I don't believe that definitions and understandings comes through relationships, it comes from the identity of things. It comes from causality, but causality doesn't mean that there are contradictions. That's why I have this problem with this understanding of the world based on relationship and saying, for example, that the minds or values produced this way in that system, but is produced in a different way in another system.
Well, we'll say that last bit again.
So that's a usual kind of disagreement I used to have with Ashley. So the idea, for example, that I cannot understand this idea that there are different laws of value production, let's say in capitalism, and different laws of value production in ancient Rome. Because in both societies, if you take some rational people and they leave behind, let's say, whatever, if they're free to produce, if they're free to create, in both cases, they're going to come up with the same relations of production, which is going to be rational people creating values and then being free to exchange these values with each other.
But can you imagine that in ancient Rome, there might have been something like a board game with one set of rules, and today there's another board game called Monopoly.
Of course, but that's not a contradiction, and that's not
okay,
that's
but,
not a theory of
But the central thing to understand is that what we're discussing is our social relationships, how we organize ourselves and cooperate together, rather than some sort of natural fact about the world. So if you can imagine the difference between a board game in ancient Rome and a board game we might play today, you can imagine the difference between setting up value relationships one way in ancient Rome and another way today. We're not actually, you know, we are creating different ways of understanding each other and setting up our modes of cooperation. So, you know,
but this can only be found, in my opinion, in the superstructure and not in the base. So I would totally agree, for example, with the effects of politics, right? That's why, and both Zizek and Peterson agreed that you cannot live a prosperous and flourishing life in North Korea. But I cannot see, and that's my problem with Marx, why these relations are not determined at the level of the superstructure, but are related to the level of the base. Because on the level...
Let me give you an example where it's at the level of the base and the social relationships you set up will change the mode of production and the value, right? So let's say that I've got a bunch of friends together and we're going to bail water from one location to another. We can organize it so that we have one pail and we pass it amongst each other down a line. We can organize it so that everybody has a pail. And the outcome is going to be different depending on how we organize it. So that's the same thing. We can also make it a game, in which case, you know, we can say, if you bail this amount of water, you'll get these sorts of social rewards. All of these things are going to change not only our relationships with each other, but how much water gets transported.
Of course.
Right.
But
so there you go. That's the base. That is the base. Yeah. There's no other base than that kind of base, than the way we organize our productive activity. And I've just demonstrated that you can imagine easily how that can change, not just over centuries, but even in an afternoon.
Yeah, but the starting point here is that you people took the decision to relate to each other with a specific way. And this, let's say this was, and actually I could say you can even predict which of these schemes is going to work better. So the fact, for example, that one scheme is going to work better than the other scheme has to do with how each scheme is going to let you people to produce and live your life as human beings. So for example, which means In order to live, I have to think. In order to think, and then I have to translate my thought into production. And if there is a system that does not allow me to translate my thought into production and, let's say, loots me or plunders me, then I will perish. But again, I don't think that the key here is the mode of production. The key here is, are you free to think? Are you free to act? Are you free to produce? And then are you free to exchange? Which is, if we move this a bit forward, for example, we can see why Peterson is not even a very good advocate, although I have all the respect of the world for him, for his how brave he is. In my opinion, he's not a great advocate of free speech because he does not locate free speech where it should be located, which in my opinion is, again, in order to survive, in order to live, you have to think and you have to be free to think and express your thoughts. That's the starting point of free speech. And also its starting point is the right to property, because otherwise you cannot have free speech. So in the same way that he did, let's say, a clumsy defense of capitalism, he also does a clumsy defense of free speech. And again, all the respect, I'm so thankful that he's so courageous and he's doing all these things. But if we don't take the things down to the starting point and to very clear concepts, we cannot define them and we cannot even win political battles.
Yeah, but you're taking things down to a very clear points that are ahistorical. So you're saying like, oh, the starting point is private property. So when?
Yes.
When?
No, the starting point, I said, is the mind. I said the starting point.
No. When should we have private property? When it was expropriated in order to be forced into the wage labor relationship?
Sorry, say again. I've missed one part.
You said the starting point is we have to have private property in order to be free, et cetera. And I said, when do we have to have private property? Now or when we had the commons and people were forced off common lands, for example, and forced into wage labor relationships? We're not free. We don't make that choice freely. I've heard you say that it's like Uber is this wonderful thing because you're free to be like a taxi driver one day. And you know, it's like it's just like what Marx was saying in the German ideology, right?
Yeah.
You're like except that you're not doing that because you freely want to do it. You have to do it because you can't get a living wage out of, no one would work seven jobs.
Yeah. Like
you
I get
would
do it,
that
yeah.
If you didn't, if you freely, truly, freely chose to do that, you would do something totally different with your life.
I get it. Two comments on that. On the commons issue, of course, this is a clear violation of individual rights if someone kicks you out of your land. Having said that, I don't think the rise of capitalism is necessarily created related to the commons because this is a historical example from one country. But that's not the whole point. My
this
problem with
historical example from one country.
Sorry?
This happened in loads of different countries.
Well, for example, it didn't happen in the United States. It didn't happen in Netherlands. But again, the people are going to get bored if we discuss like the history of the commons. But here's another thing. Your disagreement with my Uber example, which is kind of was my transition from Marxism to, let's say, free market, that free market capitalism is the latest state of communism in a way. You claim that if people, you say they are forced to work, but the only one who is forcing us to work is reality itself. Because we have to produce our stuff. We are not self-sufficient. We're not, let's say, flowers. We cannot just absorb. We have to, and again, we go back to Aristotle. Everything has a nature, everything has an identity. Our nature as human beings is we have to think and we have to produce. So the fact that I have to wake up and, you know, work for an employer if I don't want to work for myself, and sometimes maybe I haven't got any other option, totally understood, but this does not negate my freedom. Because what you are actually saying is that this would actually the other way around. This would be, you are saying that reality is basically an oppressive force in a way, because reality doesn't guarantee our survival. So that's why I always say we have to start with reality, right? Reality requires that we produce and that this is the way we survive and this is the way actually we flourish. This is our nature as human beings, and this is not a deterministic like biological, it's a very simple argument. So that's why I still consider Uber, let's say, a move forward towards, let's say, a post-scarcity world.
I'm sorry I laughed. I just, it seemed like such a jump from what you were saying to Uber. But let me just say this. Listen, we've almost talked for, I think we've talked for about an hour.
Right.
And I want to shift the ground.
No, he's not letting me. He's not getting away with what he just said.
Okay. You go ahead. Go ahead, Ashley, and then we'll shift the ground.
We have to the way that we reproduce our existence under capitalism, you've just like smuggled in capitalism, this historically specific relations of production, as quote unquote reality. Mm-hmm. So you could easily say that about feudalism. So we're sitting here in feudalism and I'm like, geez, it sucks that we have to like live like this and give a certain amount to the feudal lord. And you're like, well, you know, reality is hard. And the nature of human beings is that we have to work and reproduce our existence. And I would say, well, okay, sure. That's true. And therefore, feudalism is fine.
No, so, it's not, because in feudalism, you are not free even to think and to act. In capitalism, you are free to think and act. But
how are you more free to think and act when you...
Let me just interject here and say something a little different. We need to continue this conversation. This is just the beginning, okay? We should do this again, all three of us, and each one of us on our own and all of that. But because this was a lot of fun for me, and I actually appreciate where we ended up, because we kind of ended up where we started as to whether or not we want to start with a clear-cut definition that's, fixed and kind of an essence for all time, or whether we want to try to describe our situation, leaving it open for more understanding. But I want to point out something else. You said that we shouldn't go through the history of, I'm not sure exactly at that point what it was, but the history of the development of capitalism, say, in the United States, for instance. I think that might have been what you said, because that will be boring for the audience. And it reminded me of a conversation I had recently with a sectarian. Well, to call him sectarian seems mean, but he's a member of a trot organization, right? And I suggested to him, I said, well, I want to do a series of podcasts where I call up every Marxist organization in the Anglophone world, so I don't have to learn other languages, and just ask them to trace their history for me and explain their ideas and how they developed. So I want to know every sectarian split that led up to this point, and I want to know. I want to know.
Good how, luck doing this in Greece.
Right, and I want to know like what the ideas are now and how they developed. You know, as best you can. I mean, I don't expect it to be complete. And the response I got was, "Oh, that will be boring," right? And I thought, no, it's quite the opposite. It'll be really interesting. But it appeared to be boring because. It was, first of all, I think something that this guy didn't want to see exposed, and maybe not consciously, but unconsciously, that it would be incredibly contentious. There's not a clear explanation. And also, it would open up problems and ideas that were being denied and swept under the rug and that were unknown. And I think like when you're a kid and you're in school and you start to be bored, there's lots of reasons why you might be bored. But one of them is that you get to a point where your self-conception is challenged because you realize you're in terrain where your competency is not – that the competency that you have isn't adequate. And you start to be bored. And so I think boredom, when we start, oh, that's going to be boring, that's a way to divert away from terrain that's not easy to traverse. So – I would just say that. And I would also say Peterson set a great example, especially Peterson, of not being bored when he was outside of the realm of his competence. So.
No, but here's why I said it would be boring, because I think we should be doing a moral defense of the one system on the other. And a moral defense has to do with what are its main characteristics. So, for example, slavery or the commons situation and the violation of the commons in the United Kingdom. Obviously, there are horrible violations of individual rights. And that's why you cannot say that these systems were anywhere near like a clear capitalist, because where is the element of individual rights? But this has nothing to do with the discussion on whether capitalism is a moral system or not. Because obviously, if you have slavery, this is not a system that is capitalism. And of course, Ashley is going to say that I create a definition, and whatever doesn't fit in my definition, you know, I conveniently say that's not capitalism. But I think we can all agree that if capitalism is private property plus individual rights, well, if you kick people out of the class.
Hey, so what is the difference between morality and ethics? Can people?
Oh, I use them interchangeably.
Right, but I think. Like, I remember thinking, morality is like whether or not
one word.
Morality is whether or not you're abiding by the social norms in a community to the degree to which you're.
Okay, then ethics would be
trying to determine what is actually right. Is that?
Okay. I meant ethics.
So whenever move to morality, but I think you meant morality because morality you can do this with, right? You can say, okay. Here are the terms. Here are our definitions. We can figure out whether or not we're abiding by them. But ethics is this process of discovery, where you're trying to change and accord yourself with an understanding, and it may have to. And you don't always have firm ground when you tackle an ethical issue, which is one of the reasons why none of the ethical systems that we have are fully adequate, like utilitarianism or. Universalist, rule-based, Kantian universalist ethics. Neither of them seem to be adequate to every situation.
Actually, even worse, they are very, very bad ethical systems, specifically Kantianism, but again, that's for another discussion. But don't you agree that ethics, there could be a way to come up with an objective system of ethics, which means related to what reality requires from us? And that's can I say that I've tried to say this from the beginning. What's my big problem with Peterson's definition of happiness? Do I have like a minute for a closing remark?
Sure. Why don't we each one take our closing remarks now? That's a great idea.
All right. So I'll use my closing remark to criticize Peterson because this was his most brilliant point and also his worst point. So he said that happiness is you're in the right place at the right time and you're doing what you should be doing in a way that expands your capacity to do even better in the future. And this is excellent. This means integration. Your life is a process, and this process has some objective requirements. For example, if I drink 5 bottles of vodka every day, I'm going to die in a month. That's not good for my life. And then he says, though, but this is an instinct, and this is not rational. So already his best argument, which is life requires reason and requires rational action, then falls down and crumbles because he says, but that's not rational. This is something that happens to you. And for me, this is the same problem that Peterson has in defending capitalism. He does not understand it as a system where at its center is the individual mind that needs to take the right decisions and do the right stuff to pursue values and to pursue a virtuous and a good life. So, yeah, that's like that's. And there's no surprise that he sees life as suffering, because if life doesn't make sense, and if life is something that happens to you, which is weird because he tells us to stand with our shoulders back and our head high, then this is why you get this like malevolent view of life, which is also related to his existentialism. So no, life is not suffering. Life can be great. Life can be flourishing if we are free to think and act based on our rational judgment. That's my call to arms.
So what reality requires of us? Do you mean biological?
Sorry?
Well, I think we're supposed to be making our closing statements here. So you can use your closing statement to critique what he just said, or you can say something altogether different. It's up to you. But he doesn't get to respond. I'm sitting there.
All right. So I know that you hate pragmatism, but I feel like that's an unintentionally pragmatist argument, because what reality requires of us is going to change depending on our time period, depending on our culture, depending on particular norms. And there will come to a point where the current arrangement will be seen as undesirable for a large number of people. And you can be on the side and say, and try to convince people to use their rational judgment to accept the way things are. But when there are contradictions, you know, we will push past the way things are and then we'll have something totally new. So this is why I say that happiness, when people say like, oh, what is happiness? People always ask me that. And I don't have any definition of happiness, because I think that and what my whole book was about is about people's attempts to try to pin it down and then criticize reality when reality fails to live up to their definition. So they'll say, oh, people are living in ways that are contrary to their own happiness. Well, then you don't look at them and say, oh, you fools, why don't you live like this? You have to ask why. You know, why, you know, people don't tend to do things en masse that don't do something for them in some way. There's something pushing people to act in particular ways. And until you understand that, you'll spend a lot of time criticizing reality for not living up to your definitions. So for me, I always just say that happiness is an openness to, what I mean by that is to self-determine, a freedom to, or the removal of barriers to do something that you want to do. And in that way, it's always boundless in this sort of Hegelian sense of this, you know, undefinable, constantly changing sort of becoming. And I always go back to the American Declaration of Independence, where people say, like, look, see, happiness has always been important. You know, the right to pursue happiness, it's written into the American Constitution, et cetera, the way people talk about this on the news and so on. But... And then they go, oh, but they didn't define what happiness is. Oh, how frustrating. Well, it's because it was about this openness, this freedom that, yeah, you know, we're not going to live like, you know, peasants in Europe. You know, you were born a peasant, you died a peasant. You're going to have this freedom, this openness to define and to become whatever. And it can't be defined, because it's always going to change as the base of society changes, as the relations change, what happiness is going to be, you know, 300 years in the future. I have no idea. I have no idea, because the conditions of existence don't exist yet, you know, to say what that will be.
Well, I'll do my closing statement, which is that it's not going to be an argument about the debate between Zizek and Peterson. It isn't even going to be a refutation of anything that was said today, but it was going to be a suggestion. Why don't we, all three of us, after we end this recording, go our separate ways, write down a few thoughts about the conversation and some questions we have that are remaining. I mean, I have a ton of them. And, you know, I have some skepticism as well about everybody, everything that was said, but especially Nikos. And come back again, share what we've written. It only has to be a paragraph or something and a few questions, and set a new topic and debate again.